I'm Terry Fretheim, and I teach Old Testament at Luther Northwestern Theological Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. And I'm about to begin a sabbatical year at the University of Chicago. So I'm looking forward to the different pace of things to come. Today we've entitled the section, One Response to Suffering, God Takes Job to the Zoo. Now I got taken to task a little bit in the first hour this morning for putting zoo. I should have said God takes Job to the wild. And I think that she might be right. That would have been a little bit more appropriate. That zoo is too much of a confining word for what goes on, even though it's a rhetorical effort. It's too much control for what happens in these chapters. And I invite you, we'll begin by doing some reading. 38th chapter of the book of Job. You're all familiar with the basic storyline, I'm sure, of Job, that for some 37 chapters here, there's a dialogue between Job and his friends, or his non-friends, as the case may be, with regard to the deep, pervasive suffering in and through which he has gone, which affects not only his family, but his own body. And Job has asked, indeed demanded, that God show up to explain himself with regard to this state of affairs. And the interesting thing about the book is that God does, in fact, show. And this begins, in chapter 38, the longest speech of God that you have in the Bible. And it's really a rather remarkable piece of literature. My guess is that unless you're a regular Bible reader, you've not even heard these passages. They're never read in church. I've never heard, I don't think they're a part of any lectionary system that I know of. Nobody preaches on them. Part of that has to do with the fact that for years, scholars thought that these God speeches were kind of an editorial appendix to the real book. But nowadays, scholars, the latest commentaries in the book of Job, view the book of Job as a unity, as a whole. And hence the God speeches are sort of coming into their own as a clue to the meaning of the book. Now, what you'll see here is that Job, God does not directly answer Job's questions, but two things you might notice as we read, and we'll come back and talk about them a little bit. One is just the range in God's response to Job. Where does God take Job in his mind now? Where does God take Job? And secondly, what is the form of the response of God? How does God frame the sentences? What kind of sentences does God speak to Job when he responds? So let's do a little reading. I think because we don't read these much at all, that a few extra moments reading here might be helpful. We won't read the whole thing, obviously. Beginning with chapter 38, verse 1. The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Now notice there, whirlwind. God doesn't come to Job in church. Okay? And I mean, it's not in a religious setting. It's not through sort of the typical ecclesiastical or theological channels that God, you know, that God comes to Job. It's out in the natural order. It's out in the world. And it's disruptive, a whirlwind. You know? There are things popping here, folks. It's not in, you don't have a still small voice of Elijah here. You've got a whirlwind. Now, let's start with verse 22. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed? Or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? Who has cleft a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt to bring rain on a land where no human being is, or on the desert in which there's no human being? There's rain out there, folks. To satisfy, what an interesting word to talk about the land, to satisfy the waste and the desolate land and to make the ground put forth grass. Has the rain a father, or who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb did the ice come forth? Or who has given birth to the hoarfrost of heaven? We're skipping a verse. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth the Maseroth in their season, or can you guide the bear with its children? I wonder, can you guide the bear with its children? The bear is the constellation. And what's the children? That's the constellation of the little bear. Okay. Neat way of expressing that. Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you establish their rule on the earth? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that a flood of waters may cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Beginning chapter 39. Do you know when the mountain goats spring forth? Do you observe the calving of the hinds? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they bring forth? When they crouch, bring forth their offspring, and are delivered of their young? Their young ones become strong, they grow up in the open, and they go forth and do not return to them. Who has let the wild ass go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift ass? To whom I have given the steppe for his home, and the salt land for his dwelling place? He scorns the tumult of the city. He hears not the shouts of the driver. He ranges the mountains as his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will he spend the night at your crib? Skip a couple of verses. Verse 13. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions and plumage of love? For she leaves her eggs to the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them, and that the wild beast may trample them. She deals cruelly with her young as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, yet she has no fear. Because, interesting phrase here, God has made her forget wisdom and gives her no share in understanding. When she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider. Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with strength? Do you make him leap like the locust? Skip down to 26. Is it by your wisdom that the hawk soars and spreads his wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the rocks he dwells and makes his home in the fastnesses of the rocky crag. Thence he spies out his prey, his eyes behold it far off, and his young ones suck up blood, and where the slain are, there he is. And it goes on. Remarkable texts. Just let me give a few comments, and we'll try to open it up for some. We need to read the end of it. Turn to chapter 42. Job answers God in chapter 42. And let's just take a look at verses 5 and 6. I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. And after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz, one of the three friends, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. That's a clue to the meaning of the book, that last phrase, namely, Job has spoken aright. And God says so. So whatever meaning you make of the book, all of Job's complaining and ranting and raving and all kinds of things, demanding God show up and, you know, explain himself, God says at the end, Job has spoken what's right. Well, what do you say then about verse 6? Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. It's unfortunate the word repent is translated here. This is not the Hebrew word which is used in the Old Testament for people to repent of their sin. That word is shuv. This is a Hebrew word nekam. And nekam is not used to talk about repentance of sin in the Old Testament. In fact, God is usually the subject of this kind of repentance. And it has to do with a reversing of oneself. And Job actually now moves into new ventures with God away from some of the directions that he had taken. We'll try to talk about that a little bit. Now, there have been two major directions in the interpretation of Job, both of which now are falling into, disarray. They're not looked up to as helpful. One is on the one side where Job, you have a divine barrage here, if you will, and Job just gives up. God comes in and tells him, who are you to go about asking these kinds of questions, Job? I mean, when you look at the world around you, you're just plain dumb. That's been an uncommon interpretation. But the problem with that is they don't take into account that statement at the end that what Job has said is right. And also, it ignores tends to ignore the content of the speeches of Job. A second popular interpretation, and one that has some value, continuing value, is Job acted correctly in raising all these questions, but that the point of the story here is that God comes to Job, and God is present with Job in his suffering, and God reveals his care and concern for the world in that coming to Job. So he does experience the healing presence of God, and he's not put down for his questions. So you have the love and the graciousness and the care of God lifted up in that particular interpretation. But both of these perspectives have one thing in common that's somewhat problematic, and that is both of those perspectives, both of those interpretations of Job, stop the questions. In the first way of interpreting, Job is just put down for what he said. And in the second interpretation, you get just the word is God loves and cares for you, as God cares for the world as a whole. And if you get that message, then you don't have to get that, you just read what Job went through and you don't have to go through it, see? And so, in effect, that stops the questions too. And there's emerging a new interpretation, and I'd like to share some of that with you. And there's a book in the library, if some of you really want to explore this, there's a major commentary, I think it's about 600 pages long, on Job, but it's just recently been published by Norman Hobel, H-A-B-E-L. Norman Hobel is a Lutheran who used to teach at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, and is now, I think he's in India.
No, he's gone now.
Is he gone now?
He left. Yeah,
where is he at, Sammy?
Well, he's back in Australia again.
He's back in Australia?
Yeah.
Okay. And he's a remarkable exegete, and I think that his interpretation of the book of Job is really one of the finest there is. It's, if not the finest. There's another commentary on the book that's very helpful by Gerald Jansen, J-A-N-Z-E-N, who's an Anglican, who teaches at Christian Seminary in Indianapolis, I think is also very helpful. The questions of God to Job here are genuine questions. Now, I remember I asked you to think about the form in which God comes to Job. And God comes to Job, and God, it's one question after another. Do you know? Can you do? It's just on and on and on. The interesting thing is that all of Job's response to God has been questioning God, and now God responds to Job by returning in kind and just comes back to Job with a whole list of questions. What's going on? The questions of God to Job are not a put-down for Job's presumptuousness or trying to suggest to him that he's exploring where he ought not explore. Not at all. The questions, rather, are an invitation. They're an invitation, a challenge to Job to engage more deeply into the probing into the universe. Job has just begun to do that, but he hasn't even thought of many, many directions for that probing. And so the questions that God places before Job and before the reader is a vocation to a task to explore the world, to look into, turn over every stone, if you will, to look behind every bird, every wild animal, every tree, every star, and try to discern more of what God is about in this world. The questions, you'll not finally run out of questions. It's kind of interesting. If you were to go through this list of questions that God addresses to Job, we know the answers now to some of those questions. Simply through scientific endeavor of one kind or another, we know about something about the mountain goats, and we know something about the ostriches, and we know... Today, if God were to come to Job, God would have to have a different set of questions. A little bit, you know, they'd be a little bit more probing, a little bit in greater depth and breadth in view of the knowledge about the world that people have gained in the centuries since. The point of God's questions to Job are not that Job could not know, but that Job does not yet know. And there's a big difference. The problem is not that Job could not see, but Job doesn't see far enough. He doesn't see deep enough, broad enough, wide enough in the world. It's a problem of Job's limited vision with regard to what God is about in the world. So the point is not just, Job, there's a lot you don't know. It's also, Job, broaden your vision. Take a trip with me to the zoo. Take a trip with me into the wild. Let's look at this world of which you are part and see everything that's out there and look at the length and breadth and depth of God's working in the world. Job, explore, explore, explore. Ask questions. Probe. Don't quit your questions. Yes. So, one of the things about in Hobbes' commentary, he talks about the fact that in these chapters in the book of Job, that there are sort of structural concerns that God brings forth, that God's concerned about certain natural laws that are operative in the world as a whole. God's also concerned about issues of providential care and God's concern for this and that animal or aspect of the world. But there's also, and this is one of the fine things about this these sections, is that God emphasizes the incongruous, the bizarre, the ambiguous, the playful. I mean, the stuff about the ostrich and then the eagle and the prey. And I mean, there's you look around the world and there's things that are just plain strange, bizarre. What do you do with that? Well. Just these comments with respect to that. A world is depicted here which is governed by a certain amount of freedom, although there are certain limits. You have the sun and the rain for the just and the unjust. Natural laws govern the cosmic order of things. But there is in all of this no sort of mechanical operation of a moral causality, as if you do this, then this will happen inevitably. If you don't do this, then this will happen. No, the world doesn't work like that. If you do this, this may happen, but not inevitably. The innocent may suffer. The wicked may prosper. there's kind of a loose causal weave in the world where things just aren't rigidly set up in terms of cause and effect. The moral order has considerable flex in it. God cares for the world, governs the world, but it rains on the just and on the unjust. And there's drought for the just and the unjust. Now, God admits, particularly in the last two chapters that we didn't get into, God admits that there's evil and chaos in the world. But God is determined not to annihilate it, but to contain it within certain boundaries. Go back to the flood story, just a digression here. What happens in the flood story? What changes? The flood comes because sin and evil are so pervasive in the world. The flood happens. Is there any less sin in the world? The people who are alive at the end of the flood are just as sinful as they were before they went into the flood. There are just few of them around to sin, that's all. One of the basic changes that occurs in the flood story is that God changes. God gives a promise at the end of the flood story, what? I will never do this again. Isn't that a remarkable kind of statement from God, a commitment from God? I'll never do this again. I will never visit the earth in flood-like ways again. I will not seek to annihilate evil and sin in the world in this way again. We'll go with the world, come what may. But I won't take the route of annihilation as a response to the way of evil. That sort of reminds me a little bit of that story in Jesus, you know, where the disciples and Jesus went into this town and they were utterly rejected. And they came out of town, and the disciples sort of said to Jesus, well, why don't you visit them with a little lightning bolt or two, you know? And Jesus said, no, that's not my way. So here, too, God has determined not to annihilate evil, but to contain it. And the universe is a paradoxical universe where you've got these opposites going for you all the time. You've got the regular, and you've got the unexpected. You've got the good, you've got the bad, you've got the clear, you've got the ambiguous. You've got chaos, you've got order. You've got the successful, you've got the prosperous, you've got the sufferer. You've got eagles, you've got ostriches. You've got wise, you have foolish. You've got the comic, you have the controlled. You've got the bizarre, you've got the beautiful. You've got the serendipitous. Oh, what would we be? Where would we be without serendipity? The serendipitous and the serious. The innocent do suffer unjustly in a cosmic order where things operate without divine intervention. If you go up on top of the mountain and you decide to jump over the side, you're going to fall and you're going to get hurt. There is a moral order. But there's no mechanical law of retribution, which means that if you do this, this is automatically going to happen. Good will commonly issue in success. Evil will commonly issue in disaster, but not inevitably, not necessarily. There is room for chance. There's room for ambiguity. There's room for unexpectedness. God's world is not a predetermined order of things. It's loose, it's flex. There's all kinds of things that are just, you know, it's like floating, if you will. God creates space for people to be free with all the potential consequences for the suffering of the innocent and the prosperity of the wicked. And life in this world has a certain interconnectedness to it, so that everybody, the innocent out here, it's like a spider web, isn't it? And then something happens at one point in the web, and some wicked person commits evil, it's gonna ripple out into other areas of the web, and the innocent out here just may get effect from that evil. Act. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. And this is very important for a positive side of things. For only if you've got this kind of world, only then is there possibility for growth. Only then is there possibility for creativity. Only then is there possibility for genuine novelty. Only then is there possibility for genuine surprise. If everything were all tight, you wouldn't have surprise, you wouldn't have novelty, you wouldn't have genuine creativity, you wouldn't have progress. But in order, if the price for those kinds of things is the negative possibility. So in, with, and under the design of the world then lies this wisdom of God, a wisdom which is not finally fathomable, but is in the best interest of all. And what Job finally discovers is that this God of wisdom is a God who encounters him in honest confrontation. Job questions God, God questions Job, and God is known more fully through passionate questioning. And God just throws more questions at Job, because one response to suffering, Job, is keep exploring, keep asking the questions, keep probing. And the more you ask, the more you explore, the more you try to dig it all out, the more you'll be able to understand what it means to suffer. And just a couple more sentences, and then let's open it up. So, the book of Job is violently, almost violently, against complacent submission in the face of suffering. It's violently against a notion that somehow certain questions about God, or certain questions about suffering, or certain questions about morality are somehow out of bounds. No. If you don't have all these questions humming for you, if you don't keep your mind alive, if you're not constantly probing into God's ways in the world, then your questions, I think, or if you have a sort of ready compartment for all your questions, where everything is kind of all nice and neat, then it doesn't correspond to the world, where everything has a certain flex in it. If you don't have the questions, if you're not open to the questions, when the whirlwind comes, then it'll be incomprehensible too. Because in the whirlwind are all the questions, and they won't match your questions because you don't have the questions. And God then really will be silent, because we have no ears to hear, because we haven't got the questions. So God comes not with an answer, if you will. God comes with questions to explore and to move out into the world. If we don't have the questions, we'll not be able to hear God pressing us, God confronting us, God challenging us, God inviting us to explore ever more deeply into his world. God will not be able to lead us into his ways more deeply through the gift. What is it, finally? It's the gift of further questions. And that, so the response, finally, is Job, God leads Job out into the wide range of the world. Job gets beyond the focus of, which is narrowly upon himself and his own suffering. And God not only opens up the world to Job, but opens up the world in terms of questions. There's an illustration that I think helps, it doesn't capture it all, but it helps explain some aspects of these chapters. Some of you may have heard it. The Coach Mackay, who used to coach football at the University of Southern California, went on to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, I think. But when he was at the University of Southern California, the USC lost the Rose Bowl in a close game one year. And he came into the locker room afterwards, and there were all his players, you know, bemoaning this defeat and with their heads in their hands, wondering And he had only one thing to say. He said, "Fellas, you know, there are 800 million Chinese people who never even knew we played." You know, and in many ways, that's what this is about at the end of Job. Look at this world you haven't even begun. And the questions. You need the questions to uncover it. Okay.
And I said, I challenged you. It was partly just to get something going. But I said, you know, why can't we just accept that God's the creator and we're the created? That we don't have to understand and explain everything that happens in our world to our liking. And I'm gathering from Job that God was upset and passed judgment on these so-called friends of Job because they kept trying to make him feel guilty for asking these questions, for searching for answers, for justifying the suffering.
And the friends, too, have such a tight system. I mean, Job is suffering, it must be because of this. It's got to be because of this. If you're not suffering, then you've been doing everything just okay. And also, the friends have got God's world all boxed up. And God's world works like this. And that's a problem. Yes, sir.
Is the wisdom literature, Job and Proverbs, starting to become, you mentioned that the new commentaries, is that a new cutting edge that, you know, theologians are starting to realize that has much more depth and richness than what previously, because like you said, to me it's a shame that the lectionary leaves out almost, you know, 80% of the Old Testament and a lot of the wisdom literature.
Yeah, I think a quick word about the history of biblical scholarship over the last century. There's been a preoccupation of scholarship with what we might call generally a God who acts in history. And hence, the historical narratives and the key historical events in Israel's history have been lifted up and given special attention. And it's believed that, God is what not only acts in history, but reveals himself in special ways in historical events. And there's been suspicion and reticence and uncertainty with regard to all of this natural order material and the probings into the workings of daily life and sort of the general wisdom concerns. They've taken a back burner for 100 years and more with all this preoccupation with history. And now it's beginning to turn around. Particularly since the early 1960s, when there were a couple of articles, one written by my doctor father, James Barr, and really you kind of showed some of the great difficulties in this perspective, not least that it ignored great sections of the Old Testament, including passages of this kind. And now scholars are beginning to probe these texts in ways that they haven't for many, many years. And it's kind of interesting, that may be it relates also to their use in the life of the church. I mean, if pastors and ecclesiastical officials and so forth are reading Old Testament materials and those Old Testament materials aren't dealing with materials, they tend to ignore them when it comes to setting up lectionaries and so forth. So hopefully we'll get more of this material into new lectionaries as they are constructed. But don't count on it. You still have a great hesitance, I think. Even, you know, there's a lot of wisdom literature that deals with social realities, relationships among people.
Right.
And actually, there's more probably social, interpersonal stuff than there is relationship between the human and the natural order. There's still a lot of hesitance to work with nature materials in the Old Testament. Old patterns die hard. Yeah. What the problem is. Lynn.
Yes, we used Job for a number of years, more than 10 years, in interdisciplinary class, and we always used the Oxford Annotated Bible. I believe the Oxford Annotated Bible has always emphasized the main part, not the ending. And I think it still does, as far as I know. But it emphasizes what you did, in terms of the this questioning of God, and you're saying the recent interpretation also take God's side as much, you know, hold up more than that tradition, and even the Oxford. But my question is this: what do you? My understanding of the tradition, the one that's been taught the last 20 years or so, is that they almost dismiss the last from 10 down to 17.
Yeah.
What do you do with that? And what does the recent interpretation do with the ending?
One of the reasons why the ending is so difficult is that everything, Job gets everything restored to him. And everything is sort of not only back to normal, but back to normal in spades. And people have had difficulty with that because a life doesn't often work like that. And I think that part of the problem is it does work like that once in a while. Okay. And this is a story that works like that. And so part of the difficulty has been to see Job as sort of typical sufferer. And everybody's experience is going to be like the experience of Job. It's sort of like the mistake the Lutherans make, that everybody's experience with God is ought to be like Martin Luther's experience, and that's just not so. And the in this book, you've got one probing. My title was One Response to Suffering. Okay, it's only one. And I think that Job is fiction. I don't think it's the story of an actual person. It may be drawn on some life experience, certainly, but I think it's woven, it's a tapestry woven out of a variety of experience. And and it's just one way of telling a story and one way of bringing it to an end. And why not to expect, you know, okay, if I move through suffering like Job moves, that I'm going to have everything restored in spades, you know, finally when I'm through it all. But given the loose causal weave, life just might work like that. I think a book could be written with a quite different ending, and life might work like that too. So that's
how. Emphasize one probe, one story, one book, and not two, like the most.
Right. Popular. Yeah. I think the Oxford Annotated. I think Samuel Terrian's responsible for the annotations in this version tends to emphasize the God speeches in terms of the sort of the love and the care and the graciousness of God that's shown throughout the natural order of things. And if by looking at all of the care and graciousness of God throughout the whole world, can see it in such expansive ways, then in focusing in on yourself, you realize that God is at work for the best in your life, in every life, in a comparable way. Now that's a helpful word, but I think it's part of the story, but it's an insufficient. It just doesn't take into account all that questioning. Yeah?
Do you think Job is very helpful in learning how to respond to people who are suffering?
I was going to ask you that. What I mean, and now that you've heard some of this, do you think that it would be helpful?
I'm wondering if a person that were really suffering with some disease or something like Job was, if the randomness of the world would be of comfort or discomfort, because the tendency would be to give them answers like his friends
did,
to find some reason. But is that a true comfort, or is it more comforting just to know that there's no real reason?
Okay, let me just continue discussion. What about yourself? Would this be a helpful response to you in such a situation? To talk about such things as chance and randomness?
I know a time that I was suffering, I kept searching for answers, and I wanted to have something concrete to hold on to. And that helped when I had a little bit to hold on to. Yet that didn't really solve the problem at all.
One of the things that I think Job says finally here is that there is no such thing as the answer. Mm-hmm. And so that's taking people down a path that's going to issue in probably more problems in the long run than resolution. And one of the my concerns in her biblical study generally in relationship to the problem of suffering is that there's sort of how you work with the problem of suffering and the issues surrounding the problem of suffering depends a great deal upon your present situation. If you're in the midst, if you're in the midst of life just breaking up all around you, you have some difficulty sort of standing back and sort of thinking through things very well. And so I think one of the things that the church ought to be about in its educational programs is it ought to be about helping people with a range of questions about these issues, teaching them how to explore all of the avenues available to one in this topic, this wide-ranging topic, so that when one finds oneself in the midst of things and one's knee-jerk responses of one kind or another in the midst of suffering are informed by all of those resources that, you know, that have been given to one in and through educational resources of one kind or another. It's just astonishing to me sometimes the range of responses of people in the midst of difficulty. And I think we could be of help to people by just trying to explore as much as possible so that maybe that range is somewhat more informed. Yes?
I was just thinking in terms of thinking of your question, that what Job's friends tried to do was tell him the answer, and that was not satisfying at all. And then what God did was come and ask him a whole bunch of really hard questions, which he couldn't answer, but it kind of shook him loose a little bit. And Job's response then at the end was to turn, was to do that repentance. And that was helpful to him. So the questions, although they didn't provide any answers, but they, as you said, they got him out of that stuck place where he was in, and so it gave him a broader perspective. And the way God did it was very forcefully, and that probably, that degree of force may or may not be helpful to our friends, depending on what's going on. But just that response, that, and I've heard it many, many times, and we all tend to do it when people are suffering and we want to help them. What we really want to do is we want to take away the suffering, and that's what we can't do. And the reason why we offer the answers is because we want to make it as if it never happened. And what we tend to do is impose denial on them, and that frequently is not the thing that's helpful to them. And I've heard people say, you know, the most helpful thing when I was grieving or when this tragedy happened, whatever, was my next door neighbor or my friend who just came and sat with me and said nothing, just was with me and let me be whoever I was.
That's a little different approach. You know that the friends sat, how many days did they sit before they said a thing? Quite a while. It may well be that that's an appropriate and helpful approach to some people. It would be to come and sit, and so it's silent presence, if you will. And that may be, as I say, one very important approach. I think for other people, that's not the way to approach it. I think the other, more like Job, you just come in with, and you open up, the topic and just explore and raise further questions, that may be that's another kind of approach. It may be helpful. My suggestion is that you have to know your audience here. You have to know the people with whom you're dealing, and some people can be helped perhaps by this way, and other people need a different approach.
You might know the timing. You need to know the timing.
Timing is important too. Yeah.
When I got my divorce, I went to my pastor, and the best thing I seemed to be doing to him was that he was taking my pain on, and I would leave depressed, and he would leave depressed, and it was not helpful, and I couldn't go back. I couldn't go back to him, because, you know, whatever it was I wanted, he was just taking it on, mm-hmm. So it wasn't helpful at all to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes?
Thanks. I deal a lot with parents with handicapped children, and I think one of the things that, as we talk as a group, that most often has been helpful is to encourage the questions of why this happened to me or why my son, you know, and I mean exactly what you're saying today is, and not necessarily to come to any answer for the other person, but somehow that they have to find their own answer, their own paradox that they're going to live with. And as I counsel other people, and as I teach classes and working with these people, one of the key things I tell them is people have to find their own space where they're going to be comfortable or uncomfortable. I mean, but you can't come with the answer. I mean, I look at my own situation with my son. I was both distressed when people come and say, well, you have Eric because you're such a good person and God trusted you with him. Or the people that came and said I was so evil that this was visited on me. Yeah. And both were very unsatisfactory answers for me.
Yeah. They're not answers, yeah.
So, I mean, I guess I would agree with you that it's allowing people to question that becomes helpful.
Oftentimes the church is guilty of shutting off questions, whether it be, as we talked about last Monday, shutting off questions for children, or shutting off questions for people who are going through these times. I would really hate to see the list of people who have left the church in the midst of suffering because they've been unable to probe and complain to God and accuse God and get involved in this kind of exercise. Yes.
I just want to say something about the physical suffering that's going on in here, because I've had rheumatoid arthritis for about 25 years. And after today, I think I could read Job and think about it the way you talked about it, but not when I had the pain. I could read about it at another time. That'd be okay for me to think about all these cosmic questions. But when that pain is there, that approach to me would not be helpful.
Yeah, that's the finding the resources at a time when there is no pain, and
I was wondering too if there's a difference between Job's companions asking the questions that God asked versus God asking those questions of Job, as the difference between someone who's suffering and their friend coming and saying, well, let's think about all these new questions, versus, you know, a child who's asking questions of his parent, that gives that child the assurance that, you know, that parent understands and is in control, but still doesn't give them all the cookie cutter answers.
I think my if I'm hearing you right, I think God comes through with the questions because God's friends didn't come through with them, and we're invited to be God, if we will. I don't think it's presumptuous. We're invited to be this God who comes in the whirlwind for our friends who are suffering.
But I was thinking of the book by the Jewish rabbi, you know, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. And to me, that's the opposite of what God's answering in Job, in some ways.
In some ways, Kushner's book tries to move toward answers, but I think the book is helpful in many ways in terms of the kinds of questions. It gets you to thinking about some things that you haven't thought about before. It raises questions that I think the traditional Christian way of dealing with these matters has not been very helpful with. At the end of the book, Kushner asks us, can you love and forgive God for all of his limitations? let's see. but there's not been many questions that's gotten my mind going.
Yeah.
You know, and it was not shortly after I read that, I went to a conference for the disabled sponsored by the Kennedy Foundation in Washington, D.C., and heard a woman, an Episcopalian priest, woman with multiple sclerosis, get up and talk about how she finally was able to forgive God. You know, and those two begin to come together for me a little bit. Well, it's that kind of probing into into these issues that I think can be helpful.
I guess the thing I understand is that, you know, one of the greatest paradoxes of all would be, you know, the incarnation and the crucifixion. If someone rationally tried to understand how a good God could allow his own son, you know, to have to go through all that, but at the same time that good God is big enough and whatever to encompass with all this mystery and wildness and things of Job, which gives me comfort that there is something versus a totally existential, chaotic world where there is no designer, there is no Genesis 1-1.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Sammy?
I think the passage that probably bothers me the most is the end of 11, you know, friends had sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And I think I had come in my theological journey or my faith journey, to come to the confidence that God is light in my darkness, no matter what that darkness is, but that God had not been the precipitator of that darkness or that evil upon me. And so often you hear, well, that must have been God's will for you, mm-hmm. That you had this child or whatever. I don't know, I came in late, and I'm not sure if you talked about that, or is that a part of the exploration that God calls us to? It just doesn't fit with my faith.
Well, Elvin had his hand up in response here.
Yeah, it's that setup deal of chapter one. Mm-hmm. I think the dialogue between God and Satan, where God then agrees to withhold his blessing, hides his face from Job, mm-hmm. and it's that scene that I think really creates this kind of fatalism.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, when I was going through some very bad times, I was very fortunate to have some friends who helped me ask the questions. And I remember one friend who said, when I was saying, why me? She said, why not you? She said, just because you're a Christian, it's not like a divine inoculation against any good, bad or evil things that will happen. That helped me tremendously. I would have gone crazy if people just sat there and just listened.
Okay, that's testimony to another. Yes?
I always feel like I'm really thankful that Job is in the scriptures because it seems like the friends are saying proverbs to him. Just be good. If you haven't been good, no wonder this is happening to you. If you're good, if you're wise, and you walk the way of wisdom, everything is going to turn out okay. And Job seems to be probing that other side. Mm-hmm. I was going to say that I taught an alternative school class in English one time, and the kids wanted to read Job, and then we also read J.B. by McLeish, and I believe Robert Frost has also written a verse play based on the book of Job, which I think says something about the enduring quality of the Job question, of suffering. And when we got through reading all three of those things, the kids said, it's still a question.
In fact, you could say another one is Carl Jung wrote a book called Answer to Job.
Oh, yeah.
And his question there was, because it did really put God on the spot, and it is the key question, that in order to atone or repent, God had to go through the question with Christ and the suffering and the death in order to answer the question of why me. That God chose then to send his own son, that it is Christ and the crucifixion that is the answer to the book of Job. Yeah. I don't know if you
struggle
with that. It's an interesting thought.
Well, I think that's a rather traditional Christian response, actually, that the crucifixion is a central way in which we see God responding, taking on himself, if you will, this issue.
Yeah, but it's God repenting of what he did to Job.
That's Jung, you mean. If you take, God treats Job, the relationship with Job, as a relationship of integrity, enters into the conversation, engages in the questions. That's key to the book. It's God's taking seriously, with utmost seriousness, all that's gone on with Job, and moving the conversation along, moving the discussion along. And Christians, of course, will respond in important ways with the crucifixion and the theology of the cross to these questions, but that's not finally answer either.
You're still suffering for it.
Right, exactly.
That hasn't gone away.
And that's the Jews' question to Christians, is if Jesus was Messiah of the world, why is there still as much suffering now as there was before? And we have new resources in Jesus with which to work through some of these issues, but not finally answers, I think. I want to come back to Sammy's comment about the will of God and evil. Both Old Testament and New Testament will talk about evil in the sense of judgment. And so we have certain texts, I think what they mean in 11 here, certain other prophetic texts will clearly talk about God as one who brings evil. And I think that the church does need to seriously reflect upon what that means. There's a tendency these days to sort of remove God from judgmental activity in the life of individuals, in the life of the church, in the life of the world. And we perhaps need to take that with somewhat greater seriousness, that whole topic. But I think you're quite right. In this particular instance, Job refuses, in the book of Job, refuses to say the suffering of Job is the will of God.
Yeah. Well, I think it raises the whole question of a retributive God. You know, does God punish me for my sins? And
yeah.
I think that's the whole attitude with which we as children grew up, which finally I think I became free of and realized that God did not will evil upon me. Christ came not to condemn the world, but to save the world. You know, and in the whole Colossians thing about the reason Christ came was to reconcile all things to himself. It just gives such a different picture of a retributive God. And I think what's happened then in our Christian perspective, and especially of the first world, is that when we have these floods on the third world countries that wipe out absolutely whole villages, well, that's because they do not believe in the Christ. And that's been a pat answer, that that is the way God punishes them for not being. And, you know, I really have a struggle with that.
Yeah, well, we are, I think many of us do. Yeah, Len.
I think this is part of the generational thing, though. I don't find that at all in young students. No awe, no fear, no idea of a God as a judge or retributor. It seems to me I was raised in a different world. My children.
Yeah.
And the 60s seems to be the turning point for the church and for my children and confirmation and the whole religious experience.
Definitely.
I think yours is the same as mine,
right,
but not my children.
I want to come back to one other comment that Eldon raised too about the prologue and the wager or the contract. I think you have to be very careful not to read that chapter in terms of history. I think what the book is a theological construct. Sets it up, okay. And it sets it up in such a way that you open up a whole variety of avenues of response to the issue. So you can't get stuck back into that sort of the scaffolding that the first chapter sets up. Yes.
Continuing on the discussion about God and evil, I think there are a couple of ways of looking at that. And the point you raised earlier, I think, is important. You'd say that we don't need to look at every single thing that happens, every detail of our lives, in terms of cause and effect, in terms of punishment and of sin and retribution. So that the suffering of a child, you know, isn't because the parents did such and such or whatever. So that those kinds of things are part of the order that we live with, and then that raises the question, though, if this is the created order that God has created, continues to uphold, then is this built into this system? And in that way, is the question of Job or the accusation of Job a valid one? You know, is God, you've created things this way where we don't really like it sometimes?
Yeah, there is a sort of deep philosophical question. Couldn't God have made a world a little bit different from this that might have made it better for more people? You know, those are that kind of question. And I think that the statement of faith would be finally that this is the best world possible. In spite of these issues that are raised. Yes?
What really makes sense to me is that the world is still in the process of being created, that it isn't finished yet. And we can look at all kinds of different examples that we get very insecure, we human beings get very insecure when we think that things are open-ended. So we want to close it when we have it together. And we want God to be the ultimate end bracket. God to be the ultimate one, to have the answers and to be finished and to know what's going on. And it's like, especially reflecting what you said this morning, I never thought of Job in these terms, but it's like we are still in the process of creation, and that's why we need the questions. It's because God needs us to ask the questions, because we are part of the creation and we're all kind of moving together, including God in some way. And we want the answers to the suffering, we want the answers, we want it to be finished, but it just isn't finished.
Yeah. It is disconcerting to have God come to you and not give you an answer, but more questions. But I invite you to have more questions and to continue your explorations. And tomorrow we talk about non-human sopranos and tenors. So we look forward to that. Thank you very much for today.